Hello, I'm Eric Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled Longevity Clinics Promise Better Health and Status by Alex Janin. Michelle Salpala wrote $500 sheet, Why I Took the Leap. Letty Teague wrote, Everybody Knows Josh. What brand can match its success? Then we have an article by Greg Likov, Give Students Learning Accommodations. And we'll follow that up with an article by Mike Kerrigan, The Dude Digs Mozart. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Longevity clinics promise better health and status. For up to six figures a year, longevity clinics promise to buy their patients longer, healthier lives, and sometimes maybe just as valuable, status. High-end medical clinics aimed at optimizing their clients' health for years to come are proliferating as demand for their often experimental treatments grows. A few hundred such clinics operate in the United States, longevity doctors and market researchers estimate. Most of them are in affluent areas in California, New York, and Florida, according to research and media company Longevity Technology. Longevity clinics can charge hundreds to thousands of dollars for services such as biological age testing, preventive body scans, or plasma exchange, and at the highest end, $100,000 or more for annual memberships. At $250,000 a year, Extension Health in New York offers top-paying clients a superhuman package by invitation only. Robin Lee, a chef turned restaurateur, used to belong to the private social club Soho House. Now, he says, he would rather do hyperbaric oxygen therapy. He estimates he spends $120,000 a year on longevity-related care in those cities for treatments such as red light therapy and stem cell injections for his knee pain. My main priority in life is to look and feel as good as I possibly can, says Lee, who takes more than 30 supplements a day and sees a concierge longevity doctor on top of his clinic visits. He says he recently got peptide injections at a London clinic for a price on par with a table for six at the upscale restaurant Cipriani. But they will last and make me look so healthy, he says. Many doctors and scientists caution some clinics' treatments lack robust scientific evidence and could carry certain health risks. Supplements, a big part of many longevity regimens, aren't regulated at the level that prescription drugs are. That's the huge struggle in the field, says Mazarin Dotoyu, an operations lead at the National University of Singapore's Academy for Healthy Longevity. Yet the clinic's non-traditional approaches are often the draw for those with the means to get personalized care, say clients, consultants, and clinic operators. Being healthy inside and out is actually the ultimate status symbol, says Julia Klim, who advises gym operator Equinox on longevity efforts. The company launched a $3,000 a month longevity program last year that includes sleep, nutrition, and exercise coaching, and tests of metrics such as oxygen max, a measure of aerobic capacity. At Extension Health, services include peptide therapy, medical imaging, and experimental procedures such as plasma exchange, which involves removing a patient's blood, separating its components, and replacing the plasma with a mixture of saline and albumin. The clinic's lower level annual membership costs $10,000 and includes quarterly doctor's visits, preventive body scans, and comprehensive blood work. For those who get the superhuman package, we are your everything, says founder Dr. Jonathan Coe. Many of the clinic's clients, he adds, are chief executives, company founders, and celebrities. One superhuman peer client, a man in his early 50s, says he invested in the membership in the hopes of adding more healthy years to his life. His regimen at Extension includes plasma exchange and peptide injections. Corey Malkowski and his wife, Kate, belong to Miura, a clinic in Minneapolis. The roughly $6,000 a year they pay includes blood work and meetings with providers every few months. Both started taking a compounded GLP-1, the class of diabetes and weight loss drugs known by a name such as Ozempic. His first appointment, which involved drawing 12 vials of blood, was a birthday gift. As the number of clinics grows, some practitioners are seeking to develop standards for longevity care. The Healthy Longevity Medicine Society, a professional group of longevity specialists, is working to establish evidence-based guidelines and standards for the clinics, as well as training for healthcare professionals. The standards include definitions for concepts such as biological age, a measure of how fast or slow a person is aging physically, and health span, how long a person lives in good health. Physicians are required to have formally trained in healthy longevity medicine or have experience in related fields. Oreski says his clinic membership is paying off. He credits the GLP-1 regimen with helping him reverse his pre-diabetes. And now, $500 shoot. Why I took the leap. The other day, I threw open the windows, ready to spring clean and flip the mattress. Then I started to strip my bed, only to see sheets shredded by my husband's toenails. How long has this situation been developing? I spend 8 hours a day physically interacting with my bed sheets, so how did I miss this? We all have private, recurring bedroom fantasies. Mine is that every night I tuck myself into crisp, unwrinkled, lavender-smelling sheets. But the sad reality is I give my bed sheets no attention. And on the rare occasions I do buy new ones, I get another cheap $150 set that wrinkles, doesn't wear well, and feels limp after the fourth go-round in the laundry. But spring is a season of renewal. Maybe I can change with help. I'll spend money on things for myself, like a $500 pair of boots, so why not on the bed sheets I use every day? I asked Charles B. Lindsay, an associate professor of marketing at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Lindsay, whose research focuses on how consumers make choices, says it's not unusual for shoppers to spend more money on items other people see. Clothing is a very public product, and you get social status from it. There's the emotional satisfaction when someone says, "I love your sweater," he said, but bedding is very private. You may be thinking, "Oh, that's just something I sleep on." A few centuries ago, I probably would have been more attached to my sheets if I were lucky enough to have them. Before the 18th century, many people didn't. They didn't even have beds, much less separate rooms for sleeping, said historian Annie Coggin, an associate professor at Pratt Institute School of Design in Brooklyn. They slept on the floor or with the servants. In the American colonies, beds and bedrooms were a symbol of wealth and status. In probate inventories of the time, there was a hierarchy of how things were valued, she added. First was the bed linen, because a bed sheet took the most labor if you were weaving it yourself, or else it was imported from England or France, which made it dear. Then it was the table linen, and then the rugs. These days, when an expensive queen-size sheet set with pillowcases costs upwards of $500, bed linens would still rank high in the probate probate inventory of my estate. But my inner cheapskate can't help but wonder, what makes sheets worth more than my $150 set? Oh, Michelle, when you have good sheets, it's like having a love affair, said Tricia Rose, founder of Rough Linen, a sheet maker in San Rafael, California, whose Orkney linen queen size flat sheet is $217. In what way, I asked? They absorb moisture so you feel cool and sleep better. They feel fresh on your bed for longer between washings, and they will last 10 years if you care for them properly, she said. Laundering in cold water is easier on the fabric, she said, and whisk them from the dryer when they feel faintly damp instead of baking them to death. But what about wrinkling? I can't get the binding on the top sheet to lie flat even if I iron it, I complained. On cheap sheets, they sometimes don't take care to cut the fabric with the grain, she said. Also, high-quality sheets are woven from extra-long strands of cotton or flax fibers, which makes the yarn smoother, finer, and softer, said George Matuk Jr., a sheet maker in Fall River, Massachusetts, whose company's signature roll queen-size flat sheets cost $549 a piece. They're woven from cotton grown in the Nile Valley, which has ideal conditions to grow the plants. My next call was to Manhattan interior designer Gideon Mendelson. If I were your client and I hypothetically had a situation where my husband's toenails shredded the sheets, how would you convince me to buy nice ones instead of cheaping out on them, I asked. First, I would tell you what my mother, who is a designer, would say, that we should spend on our shoes and our bed linens. Those are the things we experience the most in a day. Next, he would recommend pedicure tools. I hear about toenails and dry heels, and both are bad for sheets, he said. I often put a nice pumice stone in the bathroom. Okay, I'm ready to make the leap. Any other advice, I asked? He recommended choosing a solid color to complement the other textiles in the bedroom. Sheets have to fit in with everything else because they're usually the last element you choose. So, undyed linen, I said. I lean towards a cotton percale myself, he said, but I prefer the texture of linen and have long coveted Rough Linen's heavyweight Orkney sheets. The fabric weighs 8.3 rather than the typical 5.6 ounces per square yard of linen and will last longer, Rose said. I ordered a nearly $500 set of sheets. They were nice and flat, post-washing and damp drying, and after I slept on them, so smooth, so luxurious, I was a convert. I want these sheets to last forever. So I put a toenail care kit in the bathroom. And now everybody knows, Josh, what brand can match its success? I love that it's called Josh, says Mrs. K, played by Kate McKinnon in a Saturday Night Live skit from a few years back. Regarding her wine glass wonderingly, she adds, it's a neat name for wine. The joke? How could anyone anywhere possibly be encountering Josh for the very first time? Not only one of this country's best known wine brands, but also one of its best selling wines, Josh currently has a total annual production of some 7.5 million cases. Winemakers everywhere are trying to figure out how to produce the next Josh. But how, I wonder, did it happen in the first place? And is the making of this mega brand replicable? My first call was to Joseph Carr, the 65-year-old founder of Josh Cellars at his home in Cape Cod. Carr revealed that the idea to call the brand Josh, which had been his father's nickname, came from his mother, Jean. Carr described his father as a lumberjack, noting that he was raised in a small working class town in upstate New York in a family that did not drink wine. The message was clear. Josh isn't some Napa billionaire's vanity project, but an everyman drink named after a blue-collar guy who actually preferred beer. When Carr first conceived of Josh Sellers in 2005, he was no amateur, but a savvy wine professional with years in the trade, including a stint as president of Mildara Blast, the wine division of Foster Brewing Company. Carr was also producing two modestly successful Joseph Carr wines, a Sonoma Coast Chardonnay and a Cabernet from Napa. But sourcing fruit in Napa had become a challenge. The price of grapes doubled and I was going broke, he recalled. Carr began looking for a Cabernet source outside of Napa. He met Sonoma-based winemaker Tom Larson, who was able to source much less expensive fruit from Sonoma and the Red Hills District of Lake County for what became the first bottles of Josh. I wanted to make a Napa wine, but Tom really opened my eyes, said Carr. With $70,000 from his 401k and a second mortgage on its house, Carr launched the 2007 Josh Sellers Cabernet Sauvignon, priced at $15 a bottle in 2009. The support of his late wife, Dee, was crucial, Carr noted, especially when it came to remortgaging the house. In a cost-saving move, he decided to try selling the 1,200 cases of wine himself. He drove all over the East Coast with cases in the back of his 2000 Land Rover Discovery. Took a year to sell out the wine, Carr recalled. Carr recalled one such drive from his home in Cape Cod to a wine shop in Nyack, New York, an 8-hour round trip to sell one case of wine. But in-person appearances gave Carr the chance to tell his story. He began signing every wine bottle he sold, a clever sales tactic that turned the empty bottle into a souvenir. By 2011, sales and production had increased tenfold. There was a Josh Sellers Cabernet and a Josh Sellers Chardonnay, and Josh was now a nationally distributed brand. That year, William Bill Deutsch, founder and chairman of Deutsch Family Wine and Spirit, now based in Stamford, Connecticut, and his son Peter Deutsch, the company's CEO, reached out to Carr about a potential partnership. The Deutsches thought the brand had potential. We saw an interesting story. He was honoring his dad and thought he designed a beautiful label, said Bill Deutsch. But they saw room for improvement too. We had to fix the winemaking. We liked the wine, but did not love it. The Deutsch family already had an impressive wine marketing track record. They made the French brand Jorge Dubonnet's Beaujolais and Beaujolais Nouveau famous stateside in the 1980s and 1990s, and had even greater success with Yellowtail Shiraz, the Australian sensation of the early 2000s. When Deutsch partnered with Carr in 2011, it acquired half the Josh trademark. A year later, Deutsch bought Carr out, but retained him as the face of the brand. His title is founder. They put me in a commercial wearing flannel, said Carr. Now I have a nice Brioni suit. By 2016, annual production of Josh had reached 1 million cases. Today, Josh Sellers' total annual production of just over 7.5 million cases extends to 23 different labels, including multiple itinerations of Josh Cabernet, as well as Josh Chardonnay, Josh Sauvignon Blanc, and Josh Prosecco, to name a few. The latest edition, Josh C-Swept, a blend of Pinot Grigio and Sauvignon Blanc aimed at a younger generation of drinkers, debuted in 2024. Instead of focusing on Carr, as much of the Josh campaign has, Deutsch markets C-Swept via a brand of influencers, including people who embody the coastal lifestyle, according to Dan Kleinman, chief brand officer of Deutsch. Kleinman oversees Josh Sellers' marketing with a budget he said runs in the eight figures annually. Why did the Deutsch family decide that of all the modest mid-tier Cabernets in the world, Josh Sellers was the one they wanted to own. Beyond the interesting story and the attractive label, Bill Deutsch also saw potential for growth. For Peter Deutsch, the brand was the right intersection between elegant and approachable. And for Kleiman, there was the appeal of Carr himself. The bet was that Joe's story would resonate with Josh drinkers, boomers, and Generation X. The next Josh. The Deutsches have yet to discover another Josh. For Bill Deutsch, it's a matter of finding a wine that truly stands out. You have to have something unique, a blue ocean item, he said, using a term for creating an opportunity where one does not exist. There is also the matter of the market, Deutsch noted. Wine consumption is down. Planned tariffs only increase concern. I wonder if Rodolphe Boulanger, vice president of wine and the New World wine buyer for Total Wine and More, had thoughts about the next Josh. Josh is, after all, the best-selling table wine brand under $20 at the chain's 280 stores nationwide. There are a couple of remarkable things about Josh, he said. It's a breakout in multiple aisles of the store with line extensions that all work. It's unique to have a brand that pumps in all categories. So if the timing is right and the market improves, I think I have a formula down. A pronounceable name, an appealing backstory, a decent flavor profile, a charismatic entrepreneur with a sturdy truck, plus a dash of promotional pixie dust. And now, get students learning accommodations. My Long Island High School is one of the top-ranked school districts in the country. My classmates come from Iran, China, Israel, and El Salvador, many from families who fled persecution to give their children the best educations possible. Growing up in a community where high expectations were the norm, I struggled for 16 years. I could not read a book no matter how hard I tried. I found standardized tests overwhelming, not because I lacked understanding, but because I couldn't concentrate. Teachers labeled me lazy, and my peers assumed I didn't care, even though I was working harder than anyone could imagine. Everything changed in my sophomore year when I was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Once I began taking medication and attending specialized therapy, my world shifted. At 16, I read my first book, The Case for Israel by Alan Dershowitz. I started writing and in less than a year became one of Newsmax's youngest ever columnists. In only a few months, I had gone from feeling lost to discovering purpose and passion, and my grades improved. Yet even after my diagnosis, my school denied me a 504 plan, as they always had. A 504 plan is a set of learning accommodations, such as extra time on tests and modified assignments, designed to ensure that students with disabilities have equal access to education. In conversations with students nationwide, I learned that many schools tend to offer 504 plans only when a student is visibly struggling, regardless of a formal diagnosis. This practice hints at a focus on bolstering school performance rather than addressing student needs. Further, the process for obtaining a 504 plan is unnecessarily difficult. Parents must often fight for evaluations via months of emails and meetings with school officials. Even after eligibility is confirmed, accommodations are improperly implied. For example, some students must use their extra time in their normal classrooms, meaning they face constant distractions from classmates. Many teachers also lack sufficient training on ADHD and similar learning disabilities. Individual schools, though they must comply with federal guidelines, have the authority to determine eligibility for 504 plans. These plans originate in Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is managed by the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. But 504 plans are not funded by the federal government, so school districts must cover the cost of accommodating students themselves. Some schools deprioritize or deny accommodations to avoid extra administrative burdens. A 2014 survey found that 66.4% of parents said their children's 504 plans weren't being followed properly. President Trump can solve this problem by securing federal funding for 504 plans and strengthening enforcement mechanisms to ensure that schools follow through on providing accommodations. I lost a significant part of my K-12 education because my ADHD went unrecognized for too long. After my diagnosis, I have struggled to receive the accommodations I need. The process for obtaining a 504 plan must change so that qualifying students receive support without unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles. And now we do have one more. The Dude Digs Mozart. My local classical music station is WDAV out of Davidson, North Carolina. I love listening to it as I drive about town. At least I think I do. A few recent rambles have made me wonder, are you really a classical music aficionado if your mind makes the cinematic associations that mine does? Take the Barber of Seville Overture, played on a jaunt in my pickup. A better man than I would have saluted Rossini's genius. I thought only of the sabotage scene in Breaking Away, where in a road race, the idealistic Italophile Dave Stoller realizes that even his heroes, the Italian cycling team, cheat. Later, I enjoyed another overture, this one from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. My mind shifted to contrast not between Count Almaviva and servant Figaro, but between classes in urban Philadelphia, as shown in the opening credits of the comedy gem, Trading Places. Mozart played on, but WDAV programmers shifted to solemn in Requiem in D minor, Lacrimosa. A more dialed-in listener might have had a reflective memento mori moment. I simply recalled slacker Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski discussing ransom terms fireside with his nominal doppelganger in The Big Lebowski. While driving under the influence of Ride of the Valkyries, I recognized none of Wagner's signature leitmotifs. I heard only the sound of Blues Brothers, specifically Jake and Elwood Blues, as the duo raced down an unfinished expressway with Nazis in hot pursuit. Finally came Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Hearing the iconic volley of cannon fire did not remind me of Russia's stalwart defense against Napoleon's invading army. All I could think about was the havoc that an unhinged greenskeeper like Carl Spackler of Caddyshack can wreck on a golf course. This goes for commercials too. Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, Summer, recalls not violin virtuosity, but seasonal BMW sales events. Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue compels me to fly United. Copland's hoedown crowd out all thoughts but one, how badly I want beef for dinner. Poet John Keats was right about beauty and truth. There is no shame in associating classical music with movie soundtracks or television commercials, as long as you recognize beauty on a Grecian urn or a silver screen when you're in its presence. That way, transcendent music, like the dude himself, abides. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.